All right, so I'm here with Denise Van Baren, our special collections librarian here at Worcester. It is May 24th. Hello, Denise.
Hi, Matthew.
Thank you for coming. So to begin the interview, I'm just going to start off with some introductory questions. So where are you from and how did you end up at Worcester?
I grew up outside of Youngstown, Ohio, Struthers, a very small town, still town. I went to Kent State for both my undergraduate and my graduate. After getting my library science degree, the person that I had been spending a lot of time with and I decided that we were going to get married. He just happened to be in this area. And there was a very temporary position here at the college, which was supposed to be a 5-month position. And that was in January 1985. Mm-hmm. And needless to say, I stayed a little longer.
Yes.
It's now been 33 plus years.
Yeah. Very nice. So what is your background in women's studies, gender studies, Wakes departments?
I guess I've always been interested in various topics related to gender studies. And partially that's because of my interest in dance for many years, dance and theater, as well as literature and art. And while I was at Kent, I was very involved as a student in various things, including the editing of the Creative Arts magazine. And so it was very, very much an activist campus from 1978 to 1983 when I finished up my first graduate degree. And during that time period when I was at Kent, I was very much involved with people from all of those disciplines, and doing things like Take Back the Night. And of course, we worked with women's reproductive issues during that time period, extremely a part of the time period. So that by the time I got to campus here in 1985, right out of graduate school, of course, I had more probably in common with a lot of the students on campus mm-hmm. than I did with the faculty. But because of the areas that I was interested in, the faculty in those areas, I was very lucky. I worked with the English department, so I had Joanne Fry, mm-hmm. who's also very big in women's studies, and I worked with her and her classes, and also worked with the French department, Carolyn Durham, and theater department. And so in the end of the 80s, then we also had a lot of students and faculty on campus. The circles that, you know, were ever tightening that got together. A lot of the students that I had supervised here in the library were some of the very first students who came through at the Women's Studies major. Also, there was a small group of faculty that were younger faculty. We used to meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays downtown for feminist discussion groups. So we did that in the late 80s. And then by the early 90s, more and more involvement, and some of that was, at the national level, starting to hit our campus, where I was working with people like Deb Hilty, who was interested in changing our policy, especially since AIDS was such a big crisis mm-hmm. at the time period, and worked with students and faculty here on our campus to help bring the names AIDS Quilt to campus. I also worked with students in the what was then the Women's Studies program, and was co-IS advisor on IS related to one of our collections and special collections, Mother, Home, and Heaven collection. But as I said, it was a little bit of everything, a little bit, you know, from the activist views. The campus has certainly grown, you know, to a much more inclusive campus. But back in the late 80s, I think there was a small circle of support network. Mm-hmm. Younger faculty who wanted to raise issues, who wanted to change policy, as well as students wanting to change, you know, change policy. And we had a very activist campus in the late 80s and the early 90s. So that's the way I sort of got into it. And mm-hmm. I've sort of been working in various aspects, more from the research and helping the students in terms of research in the most recent years.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Talk a little bit more about what the campus climate was like when you first came and like how you've seen a change.
It has changed a lot. I think, of course, we're always in a microcosm of what's happening in the larger world. And certainly the, coming from a place like Kent State, where it was very activist, to Worcester, which perhaps in the early 80s, we weren't seeing that quite as much. And I got here in 85, where I think it was just starting to shift a little bit. At that time period, the campus, the biggest issues tended to be more towards looking at diversity issues. But we were also starting to see more with gender, more concern. If you were just to look at the student newspaper, the Worcester Voice, and you take a look at the issues from 1985 when I first got here to the 88, 89, and certainly up through 91, because the editors were also people that were taking Whigs classes. And you will see that there were active columns that showed up every week. Mm-hmm. So you had something called Ms. Conception that was an advice column every week. And you had a lot more people being brought to campus during that time period. And we were starting to have more conversation, I think, at the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. Certainly at the beginning of the 90s, too, we saw more organization happening. When I was here in 85, it's not that there weren't these conversations happening, but as was the kind of conversation that was happening at many smaller places, well, and even at Kent, to tell you the truth, support systems and women's studies programs tended to be very confidential, and so you had things happening in a very closed knit society. So you'd go into classes, you'd go into these types of events or discussions where they were safe, protective spaces, but they were safe and protective for the people they needed to protect, which was wonderful, but they did not let outsiders in. And mm-hmm. so you didn't have that cross-pollination for people who were the allies that wanted to support what was going on. And I think that people began to push out of that bubble a little bit more mm-hmm. in the late 80s and the early 90s, and almost because they had to, because, of course, we started to see more activism around things, like I said, because it was the beginning of the AIDS crisis when it really started to hit in a big way nationally. So discrimination. So we had to look at our policy statements. We had to look at that. So the kinds of things that happened in the early 90s was a response. As you've been here for a while on this campus, and you see the way change is slow, and sometimes it requires something happening to get pushback. And you mm-hmm. see these constant pushback. We go a few steps forward, and then things calm down. But during the early 90s was a huge activist period. And perhaps that slowed a little bit after 9/11. I think everybody took a step back, and it was very peaceful in terms of perhaps not quite the activism that we'd see in the student groups. And you get those waves on campus with faculty that are here for a while, then faculty that leave, with students that are here for their 4 years. And so their organization that they bring to light, is up and running as their seniors. But if they're not the first years and the sophomores who are coming in afterwards to take up the slack. Now I'm seeing more and more voices being heard like the past couple of years. I think we're seeing another surge, which is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to see after, a couple of periods of dormancy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So were you involved at all when the program changed from just women's studies to women's gender sexuality studies?
Yes, in the sense that I've been working with the students the entire time period, and certainly these are changes that I think was always a part of what was understood among people in the program. Mm-hmm. I think to actually name and claim it was a nice change. I don't know that it necessarily for the people in the program that it changed it in a huge way mm-hmm. from what I could see, other than the fact we were finally owning it. And I think it did help, bring more people into the program mm-hmm. who felt that they perhaps, had a more of a place.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I think that was more welcoming.
Sounds like it was kind of like it was an unspoken women's gender sexuality right. studies department, but putting a name to it sort of helped it become more official, I guess.
And I think that in many ways that happens in, you know, so many different ways. You know, I hate to think how many years I've been watching this because it feels like I just got here. But I think that, you know, certainly we evolve, the language changes. I keep watching what has gone on with the various student groups and the name changes. And because I'm in archives, I have to log all those yeah. changes too. Mm-hmm. And that's quite interesting to watch how the trends will push in, you know, people so that they feel, and I think it is a sense of ownership, and to have the students and the faculty who are up and coming take ownership, and, you know, to rename is a way to claim. Mm-hmm. And so I watch as the language changes and the way things are constantly evolving. And I think it's a way to see what is happening on campus and where the pushes and the shoves, because, you know, you have these umbrella groups, and then you'd have a lot of fractures, and then you'd get an umbrella group again. And then you will see, now when I watch the posters and see all the groups that are assigned to an event, you know, and who's all helping to sponsor it, and see the partnerships that are happening, you didn't see that as much a long time ago. It was always, you know, understood that, oh, this was this kind of event, you know, this is, you know, an LGBT event. This is a women's studies event. Now when you see events that are shared by so many people, whether or not in departments, in the dean of students' office, in the president's office, it's nice to see that people are taking ownership and saying, this is our community, and mm-hmm. our community has many players. It's not just this person or this mm-hmm. person. It's a lot of mini groups coming together to sponsor. And that's a change. That's mm-hmm. a real change on yeah. this campus.
That's awesome. So my next question goes more towards the special collections mm-hmm. where you work. Can you tell me about any of the items or collections that are most used by the WIG students or faculty?
Well, one of the things that I am most proud of, and this is actually the reason why I did my first advising for an IS, was that one of my student employees, Kara Gilgenbach, who is now the curator at Kent State Special Collections, was coming through in the Women's Studies program. And I had been working to help with this collection, Mother, Home, and Heaven mm-hmm. collection. And it was in honor of Josephine Long Wishart, who was President Charles F. Wishart's wife. It's a popular advice literature for women specifically, although there, and it also includes popular advice to men as well, and to young boys and to young girls. Definitely comes out of a very Christian kind of tradition, of course. Starts with early 19th century and the idea of the angel in the house kind of thing. But a lot of my colleagues working at the library in the early 90s could not understand why we would pull it together as a collection. Mm-hmm. And say, well, these are the kinds of books you can find on anybody's grandmother's shelf or, you know, down at the used bookstore. How can you use this special collection? And it's a wonderful collection because the original collection is over 700 titles. Mm. And we've added more as we've seen things that were in our general stacks or things that people, once they saw the collection, actually added more to. Nice. That you can take a look at what was expected, what were the social norms at particular time periods for gender and sex role, to look at everything from the, of course, Christian nuclear family, to looking at roles within the house, outside the house, how these changed during periods of war, World War I, World War II. We have cookbooks. We have recipes during different time periods. But we also have things like reproduction. We work not just with WIGs, but, for example, working with the history of sexuality class this past couple of semesters. And so we could look at, you know, primary source materials. There's the self-sex books series that are very interesting because, of course, you know, when these things were not discussed, when you're a certain age, you would just get this little book beside your nightstand and say, okay, you're now a young boy. This is what's going to happen to your body. Mm-hmm. And, of course, a very binary kind of setup, you know, and this is your expectation for this time period for the girls, you know, a certain age, and then for the wedding night, and, you know, just to take you right through the steps. But there are also early contraception manuals. There are a lot of information, certainly the old Comstock books, you know, kind of things. A lot of primary source materials that are there that did help us to get an idea of, you know, what was an expectation during a different time period and how does that evolve and how does it change? For a while, we actually, and this was another way I got involved on campus, is that the early women's studies program, even before it became a program, had a little safe space over in Lowry Center in the basement that was called the Women's Resource Center.
Wow.
And it was just a gathering of materials that would be helpful. And that was definitely, when we say women's resource, it was definitely a sexuality studies and definitely not specific to gender. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a very fluid kind of collection that was being put there. And that collection kept getting shaped by books that people would leave there, journals that people would leave there, things that would come and go. I don't know how many times we would have a go through and help call, help go through and organize to make it more responsive to a particular student population at a particular time period. Eventually, this went over to Calc, and so Krista and I worked with that a while ago, and we brought those into special collections and added those as a complement to the Mother, Home, and Cabin collection, so that we now, you know, also have some LGBT materials in there, some more current materials on reproduction and other kinds of things. But those collections are being used constantly with the Weeks Department. We've had students do everything from ISs that, and studies on the advertisements for feminine hygiene products throughout the years. We've had students who have taken WIGS courses and also taken history courses who've looked at physical culture in the late 19th century and the early 20th century and done ISs like the bra and the bicycle and what this meant for history of women. That is a collection that I had to fight tooth and nail for, you know, to say, let's keep it here. Let's not split it up. Let's make it a real special collection, a popular culture collection that can be a resource of primary source materials. And it is still the most used collection that we have. And it's not just WIGS, but, you know, history, art students have looked at it. We've had soc students who've made use of the collection. But I would say definitely we always do our feminist methodologies sort of course when we do a nice exercise, and I think you were in that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I saw that collection in my junior IS class.
Right. And we also did, you know, and we do an exercise, we look at Mother, Home, and Heaven kinds of issues in advice literature, looking at ladies' home journals and better housekeeping that aren't a part of that collection, but we also have added that. Just so that way we can, you know, take a look and see, does popular advice change in the same publication, which has a specific demographic, you know, from the 1940s up through even today? And what is it being pitched at and how does this change? So that's definitely one of the biggest collections that are used by WIG students. But we've also had students who have taken a look at some of our early female faculty, because College of Worcester in our archives, Annie B. Irish is was our first female faculty, and she came to Worcester because Worcester would give her the PhD at a time that Johns Hopkins would not.
Wow.
There are other things in our collection that people make use of, but certainly in terms of the Weeks program, we've used the Mother, Home, and Heaven collection on so many different levels, from an introductory level to the IS level with many students, and they've just gotten so much out of it.
That's awesome. I think it's really cool that Worcester has a collection like that. That's become such a popular and like solid collection. So my next question, what challenges do you think small programs like WIGS face in creating digital archives of their past or like just creating archives in general?
Well, one of the problems I think we have here at Worcester is there wasn't an official college archives until I created it.
Mm.
So I worked behind the scenes from 1990 to 1995 when we opened Special Collections to start a college archives.
Wow.
So we don't have some of the general information about the college history that we're having to go back and, you know, when alums give us things. And certainly we try to, we have a lot of the student publications and the yearbooks, those kind of everyday sources that most college archives have. But in terms of student organizations and in terms of, you know, the kind of events that might have happened that weren't collected. Like, I send students out onto campus every week, and after events have happened, the flyers come into Special Collections so that we can gather those and try to keep track of them. And since I'm on the WIGS listserv and I get the WIGS emails, I can go through and archive what is happening within the department, curricular changes, that type of thing. But it's the student stories that we know that are all important, especially for the people who might have the scrapbooks, might have the pictures, might have the memories of things before we were starting to collect.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the kind of digital timeline that Marina was putting together,
yeah.
The kind of work that you're doing now to help collect those stories is a really good thing, because mm-hmm. what we're doing is collecting the voices. And the other thing is that certainly all liberal arts colleges and any kind of community, like I said, so much of it was not discussed openly prior to the late 80s. You know, that there were these little segments of things that were going on campus, that the people that were here during those time periods, if you can get their stories, get their collections, their memories, their pictures, because so much of it was done behind closed doors,
mm-hmm.
that's going to be the really hard thing.
Yeah.
You know, because there might have been something very important going on. I know that there was a very active Lambda Worcester in early 90s, but really there was a small group of students that were doing that, and a lot of people outside that group didn't necessarily know what was going on. Because there was still, even by that time period, there was a certain amount of, this is happening within our group. And yes, there were public events, but how much you're going to be able to collect about their, you know, what life every day was like for students on the campus mm-hmm. at that particular time period. Or for some of the very first students coming through in the program, it would be great if you got yeah. the early alums,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the people that became the first majors.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, okay, what was life on the campus? What did this mean to you to be one of the very first women's studies majors
mm-hmm.
and to get those voices? And you do still have some students who are still around. Sharon Rice was one of the people on campus now that she's still on campus.
Mm-hmm.
when you get to the alumni weekends and get some of those people coming back, would be great if you could do some of those oral histories with them. And if they have some of their scrapbooks or memories or
yeah.
photos, and, you know, to encourage them to build things that way. I know that other digital projects have been cultivated in that way. Brenda Meese has been dealing with the women's history and sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so every alumni weekend, she would try to get the people back, you know, and say, can you identify people in the photos? Can you do that? Just even to get the metadata
mm-hmm.
for those digital objects.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, to get the more collective memory that you can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, part of this project, I'm trying hard to talk to students who graduated more recently and more before the program. But for everyone listening, if there's not something there, get those stories. So you talked a lot about, just now, about what kinds of material you think is going to be particularly useful for the WIGS discipline to collect and preserve. But I guess another question I have is if there's a dream Special Collections you could help create or you want to see Worcester have, what would that be?
Worcester keeps changing. Mm-hmm. So I think the most important thing is that we continue to listen to what the students' needs are. Since I get to work with all of the students for the research projects, and I do get to know the students, either because of the students that I supervise in my department, you know, many of them are members of, you know, organizations that are very WIGS oriented, like NO or Vox mm-hmm. or that type of thing. I get to hear what their concerns are. And it's just, you know, as I get to see the research projects, then it's like, oh, well, we've got this. Maybe we could build in this area. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important for students to constantly, you know, say, hey, there's something here that needs to be addressed. So we need to look for something more. Certainly in terms of archives, I would say, you know, I would love to be able to have more of the student organization materials. We try to get as much as possible to try to organize them. But when the student groups are, you know, trying, you know, when I have student leaders that are associated with special collections and they know that we're collecting things, then I can get, you know, minutes, I can get flyers, I can mm-hmm. get all that kind of thing, just to document the life of the campus. That's one kind of collection. But then when you also have students who are interested in particular areas, for example, reproductive rights, then I know, for example, that there is an interest in that. Then I get, you know, people who will contact me and say, would you be interested in these books? And for example, this summer, one of the people that was associated with the college, Jimmy Meyer, who had done her work and research on reproductive rights in Cleveland, Ohio, said, you know, I'm trying to weed my collection. Would you like some of my backlog of books? And it's like, yes, mm-hmm. because this is something that was just, you know, anything that you give us is going to help complement what we already have. Mm-hmm. So it's those kind of finds. And, you know, so much of what we have in special collections that students are using are because they saw the original collection and the great use. You know, we had the original collection, and then we saw, then Jimmy Meyer said, well, because you've got this, let me add this. Mm-hmm. And we also, you know, have the Nancy Herb Seacrest collection, because Nancy, who's an alum and was a librarian, said, you know, I've been collecting women's biographies, you know, for years. Can we add that to, you know, to special mm-hmm. collections? And it's like, sure, let's, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the Worcester Network, mm-hmm. which, you know, never underestimated.
Yeah. Yeah. So you really did a good job of telling us about what Worcester has, and also what needs to be brought up and brought into special collections. So those are all the questions I have for you. Is there anything else you want to say in regards to WIGS at Worcester or special collections?
I don't think so. I think the wonderful thing, like I said, is the fact that if we can keep, you know, evolving, and, you know, because it can't be the kind of thing that, you know, it's like, well, we've collected everything that we're going to collect. Because it is an ongoing task. And I know that when you have these kind of projects that you put in place for an anniversary, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And usually for the first year after an anniversary, it's like there's still momentum. And it would be nice to you know, if students in the program could keep that momentum going and say, okay, this is not just something for the anniversary. Mm-hmm. But you know, let's remember that this is a program that is going to continue to change yeah. because its population continues to change. The faculty will continue to change. Every time you get a new faculty in, their interests yeah. are brought to this campus. Just as every time we bring new students, you bring your desires, mm-hmm. you know, your research needs to campus with you. And because of that, we have to keep going forward. So this is a great project. I would like to see that, you know, mm-hmm. that it doesn't end with yeah. a digital project or with an oral history project, mm-hmm. but that students become more and more excited about collecting their history mm-hmm. and to having these interviews with people, you know, that went before them, or, you know, or to take note of what's going on around them, because sometimes, you know, that happens at the alumni weekend 20 years down the road, mm-hmm. as opposed to as it's happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly anything that can be collected that you want to give to the archives, that would be, you know, something that we want to make sure that we look at and see what place does it have, mm-hmm. you know, to tell our story.
Yeah. Important to know. Again, for listeners, keep adding to this archive and give your own stories. Thank you so much for coming.
Okay. Thank you.